no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a
It's supposed to be an interview.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. This is episode 87. It's U.S. Open Week. It's the third major of the 2025 season. All eyes in the golfing world turn to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania and Oakmont Country Club. I'm going to keep this introduction super short, but we brought on a guest who knows a little something about playing in a U.S. Open at Oakmont. In 1983, our guest Rob McNamara qualified for the U.S. Open as a 17-year-old high school senior. He is now the general manager and director of golf at the Keswick Club, which is the club at Keswick Hall, the fantastic resort outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, and home of the Full Cry Golf Course, one of Pete Dye's last designs. Rob drove up from Charlottesville to join us at Laurel Hill Golf Club in Lorton and sat down and told us all about that week he had in 1983 at Oakmont, as well as several stories from his career, although I think we just scratched the surface on some of the stories that Rob has, as well as telling us all about Keswick Hall, the property, the resort, and the golf course. Again, keeping this really short, if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter all about Capital Region Golf at beltwaygolfer.com. It's a monthly free newsletter. You can sign up there. Just submit your email. And if you're not following already, go to our primary social media account, Instagram at Beltway Golfer, and give us a follow there. Otherwise, enjoy U.S. Open Week and enjoy episode 87, our conversation with Rob McNamara. How are you, sir? Rob McNamara, of your official title, Director of Golf and General Manager at Keswick Hall.
The General Manager of the club. So Keswick Club sits kind of, thank you, Alex, for having me. Keswick Club is part of the private component of Keswick Hall. Keswick Hall is the umbrella that really covers everything, the hotel, the spa, the restaurant, Jean George. We have a great Jean George restaurant. And then, of course, Keswick Club is the private element. We have we have local members and a great national member program.
I'm sure there's tons of folks and golfers in the DC area that are well familiar with Keswick Hall and Full Cry. I have to raise my hand that I wasn't super familiar. I think first of all, thank you for clarifying that. You got Keswick Hall, which is basically the entire property.
Correct.
You got Keswick Club, which is essentially the membership that for the golf course and those pieces. But then the name of the golf course is Full Cry.
Yes. Yeah, so the Full Cry is a reference to the area, okay. It's a fox hunting. It's horse country. It's if you want to have your viewers do spend 2 minutes and 30 seconds to get a feel for what it feels like, literally have them Google the opening scene of the movie Giant. It literally looks exactly like that. I think that was 74 years ago with Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. That opening scene when they're coming in. They make it sound like it's from Pennsylvania. Ardmore, Maryland, but it's actually Keswick, Virginia, and that is literally across the street from the front door of the entrance to the club and the property.
I'm familiar. I have to watch it. I'm familiar with the movie.
It's beautiful.
Say, I knew that James Dean was in it.
It's one of, I think, four films that he was in. And
that's all.
I'm not suggesting you watch the whole movie, but unless you want to run, I don't know. But it's mostly about a ranch in Texas. But the opening scene, literally, it's 2 minutes and 35 seconds, and it's all about right there in Virginia, right across the street from the entrance to Keswick Hall.
Yeah. But so I only really became familiar with it, I guess, or I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't played a ton of golf in Charlottesville. You know, I played Spring Creek a bunch. I have played Birdwood. I recently was able to play Full Cry. But before the big renovation, I guess in 2014, 2015?
2015, it opened back up as a Pete Dye course.
When Pete Dye
went from apples to oranges. I mean, it went from good to great, to be honest with you.
So I didn't even know about it before that. I didn't know about the property, but I just got down there for the first time a couple months ago, and it's pretty awesome property.
It really is. It is shocking how good it is. When you think, I mean, so many things. The owners, Molly and Robert Hardy, have transformed what was, like I said, it was a very good property, and it literally went from good to great. Everything that they have imagined just is at a level that I don't think a lot of people, it's not your grandmother's Keswick. You know, you see the logos, 1912. Well, that was the manor house. So that's what it references, the manor house. It became Keswick Country Club in 1946. And then kind of, you know, evolution of a lot of adjustments and just cutting to the chase that our owners, Molly and Robert Hardy, took over in 2017. And by 2018, Mrs. Hardy had imagined transforming this and making it a world-class resort. Her family has always been, not always, but for a long, long time, Kiwa Island, Sea Pines, they had been involved in some great resorts, and she made her own mark on her own, and she's done a great, great job. I mean, the hotel's 80 rooms, five-star luxury, got a great Jean-Georges restaurant, one of the most successful commercial chefs in the world, and as it relates to the people that are really probably listening to this podcast, the golfers, we have a golf course that's damn good.
You just had a local U.S. Open qualifier there just like a month ago, right?
Yep. We are now the host site. We've been fortunate enough to be asked by the VSGA and as a surrogate of the USGA on this one and to represent Virginia. We're the only qualifying site for the first stage of the U.S. Open qualifier, which is cool because the Open starts next week. So you always hope that you'll have someone that played in your qualifier that makes it all the way to the tournament and perhaps does well. So we're excited that it's really an indication of how good our golf course is.
Yeah.
I think if someone had played Keswick, you know, 15, 20 years ago or way back when it was the old Keswick Country Club before even Arnold Palmer did the renovation on it, they would have been shocked. But now that it's a Pete Dye golf course and this thing is 72 and change from the back with all the bells and whistles of Pete Dye, and we've evolved that in the last 4 years. We've added a lot to it. It has made a world of difference, and it is a real test of golf.
So just on the history of it, so it originally was
the Keswick Country Club.
Keswick Country Club. It was just like a, you know, private club. It wasn't a resort.
No. It didn't. It just, the manor house that's referenced in the 1912 under the fox on the logo was just that when it all started, it became the Keswick Country Club in 1946. Actually, people that were involved with Farmington Country Club moved to, they said, we want to have something on the other side of the county. And so then it went from 9 holes to 18 holes. And then there was a period where it shuttered the golf course. And 8 years, there was no golf. They still remained a dining club and a pool and tennis courts. And then 91, Bernard Ashley bought it and made a hotel in the Keswick Club and then went through Orient Express. And then Mrs. Hardy ends up having taken ownership in 2017. And by 2018, she was digging and building and making it like, oh yeah, she basically started over and just made it great.
So, there's a bunch of cool stuff about the golf course. I will have to get back because when I played there a couple months ago, I actually had to race back from that event that we were down for the wine deal.
Yeah.
Yes. And I actually had to come back up for all things. I'm for my 9-year-old's baseball practice that I'm a head coach.
Father of the year.
Because of that, I didn't play 16, 17, or 18. I had to leave.
Well, those are incredible finish.
And that's what I've heard. So I'll talk about a couple of the holes and some of the features that I did get to see. The two standout holes for me though were 7, which is the par 3.
The Sahara hole. It's anywhere from 110 yards to 195 yard par 3 surrounded by a giant bunker.
You want
no part of that bunker.
It's huge. It's a beautiful golf course before that, and maybe you can see a little bit of Pete Dye stuff. That's your first kind of real glimpse into, you know, a lot of the Pete Dye features.
So what I've learned, Scott Sherman who works with Davis Love had worked for Pete Dye. Yep. And Scott, he basically has taught me so much about architecture. This guy's a terrific architect and he's a great historian. You could ask him about any course, any of the 82 courses that Pete Dye's done. You can say number 4 at, you know, Teeth of the Dog or, you know, any obscure property that Pete Dye may have done that you wouldn't think. I mean, anybody can do TPC Sawgrass, but I'm talking about some remote courses that maybe no one had heard of. He could tell you everything about those holes. So we hired him and he said that Pete Dye always wanted texture. So he wanted to feel 3-dimensional so that you would have the railroad ties or the planks or the telephone poles be part of it. And we did some things when the golf course was developed. They used the old cart path from the previous renovation to use that to give it a new look and a texture. So there was a conservation element in that.
I wanted to bring that up because I think that
it's a cool damn feature.
I'm not sure I've ever seen, or if I have seen it, it's not as noticeable because the material, standard the material, like, what on earth is that?
It was stained concrete to begin with, sort of in the red Virginia clay color.
Yeah.
And so that they took these giant chunks out when they put in the whole new golf course. I mean, really a great thing to do. You didn't waste it. And they used it to build up the tees and to support some lakes that were built. And it just looks really good.
The end result, you would not guess that that was the former cart path. I mean, the way it's laid out and the way it's the stuff stacked.
It just looks like maybe that it's like boulders or something, or dirt.
It looks incredible. Yeah. But the one experience I had was, I guess it would be on the sixth, when I got down there. And I kind of jumped down the cart by myself, and I got to the sixth tee box, and I went all the way back to the back tees, and I took a couple of photos, and I peered over the edge. There's a little pond there that all the back two or three tee boxes are all stacked up, and that material, the old cart path, kind of builds it up. And I just peeked over the edge and saw
a snake.
What I saw was what I thought was the biggest black snake.
Yeah, I was going to say a snake.
And as soon as I peeked over, they all kind of like jumped out.
They figured out that's like paradise for a snake to live. It's like Pueblo Indians for snakes. Yeah. We love the black snakes, by the way. They eat the copperheads, so we're all about them. They won't bother you. Just remember that.
That's cool. No, I really enjoyed Keswick. I mean, it is a nice property, a very nice resort. You know, it's definitely a high end resort. I was there. I wasn't supposed to mention when I was there, but I think time has passed. I'm sitting at the bar. So there's a bar, not the restaurant where we ate, but there's a bar kind of on your way there.
In the hotel?
In the hotel.
Yes, that's Crawford's. That was the part of the original. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I'm sitting at the bar, and I see this guy just like his profile walk past me, and I'm the only person at the bar. And then I was like, man, that guy looked familiar. And it was the guy, it was Adam Driver, who's a very famous current actor. He played Kylo Ren in the more recent Star Wars series, which I haven't seen all of them. But then I asked one of your staffers, I guess, you know, just confirming, I was like, did I see a fairly famous person stand here? And apparently he was on a, you know, cross-country solo motorcycle trip and stayed at your property. So these are the type of folks that are staying there.
It's really nice. I mean, I would encourage your guests to come down and feel part of the spotlight, and we'll put them on the red carpet.
But very cool. I did. So one of the things when we were down there, and it'd be worth bringing up, it's, you know, this happened to a lot of courses in the Mid-Atlantic and a lot of courses in the DC area. Bermuda fairways. This was a rough winter.
It hadn't happened. When I first started working at Farmington, this was, would have been what, 94 and 95. It happened back to back years, and they have a different kind of Bermuda at Farmington. I worked at Farmington for 27 years, which is a great place also. It's another one of the great courses in Central Virginia. But they had winter kill, and they had to sprig the whole golf course twice.
Yeah.
It was so bad. And Farmington then started overseeding, and now they have great fairways. So that ship sailed for them. We have a better grass during the season, but we don't overseed because the grass is too good to overseed. Well, we had never had a problem, and we had some winter kill, but we completely resodded it in 17 days. It's all back to normal.
Is it really? So as of today, like it's.
It's where carts off the path and we're mowing it. It's mower height. It's like in some places you can't even tell that we've done it. So it was a shocking deal how bad it was. We're blessed to have owners that are committed to making a great golf course.
I mean, I know it happened to basically every course that had Bermuda fairways in the region.
It went all the way as far south as Fayetteville, North Carolina, and as far west as Louisville, Kentucky.
And I don't know as much as I should about grass, but typically that happens when you get, what is it, a dry fall and then an extra cold winter?
That's when
the amount of snowfall impact that, or is it just...
The fact that we had snow, it really turned to ice for 24 straight days. It's sort of a dehydration thing mixed in. It's a microclimate thing. There were parts of it that were completely unfazed. Only 15% of the fairways were affected. It wasn't like a little bit dead. It was like these pockets that were size of a garage that were just like completely dead at random. So we resodded them all.
Sure. Couple other, because we're going to get into your history, but since we started off here talking about the golf course, a couple other ones. So one, you, the club, the course, the resort recently did a partnership with Lauren Coughlin.
She is our LPGA touring professional. We were delighted to have her.
She's a UVA golfer. Does she still live in the area?
She does. Yeah. That's why it made sense for us. She spends the majority of her time in Florida, but she shoulder seasons us a little bit as well as in the summer. So here's a great story of success story of America for somebody that's listening that has a dream of being good. First of all, women's golf provides great opportunity, and we're getting statistics now that are showing the amount of people wanting to play golf that are first timers that are women is extraordinary, and people would be really remiss to not jump on the female bandwagon of getting golfers in your club to be involved. But Lauren was a walk-on at UVA and just slowly started getting better. And by the time she left, she was an All-American. She turned pro. She struggled. She was so close to quitting. Her story, I mean, you'll have to have her on, and I'm sure she would tell you this. I mean, her story of how close she was to taking it to the barn was tight. I think within one round in one tournament, I think it was one of those. Yeah. Johnny Miller, I'll tell you a story he told me one time about his golf that when he won his Pebble Beach event. But Lauren was about ready to quit just like that. And one round kind of said, all right, I'll keep going. And the next thing you know, she played good and had another good tournament. And the next thing you know, she had another good tournament. And here we are about 4 years later from that moment. She's.
That was only 4 years ago.
4 years ago. Ninth ranked player in the world.
Yeah. Incredible.
And when you watch her hit a golf ball, I'm going to tell you something. If you just close your eyes to watch the swing, just listen to the sound and watch the ball fly, you'd be thinking, I've never seen anybody hit a golf ball that good. I mean, she hits a five iron about 110 feet in the air, 120 feet in the air, just ripping five irons, flying 180 yards in the air like it's nothing.
Love it. Yeah, she's a hell of a player. I got to watch her, followed her for five or six holes during the Solheim Cup up here at RTJ last year, and she's a heck of a player.
Yeah.
Fun to watch. So what is that what does that relationship entail? She just kind of comes over and does promo stuff?
Yeah, well,
get out to the course much?
She does. She uses it like her club, and she and her husband, John Pond. He played college football at UVA, was the starting center, and they're an entity that, you know, he sort of manages her, and we ended up striking a deal that made sense for everybody. And we're just glad to have her as a member of the club and our representative on the tour.
She's a heck of a spokesperson, and that's a great person.
She ranked ninth in the world.
Yeah.
Won the Scottish Open.
Her rise has been impressive.
Yeah, won the Scottish Open and the Canadian Open last year. I was in Vegas to watch her play the world match play. She got beat one down. She just never could quite get comfortable to get over the hump to beat this gal. This gal just got on top of her and just couldn't quite shake loose from her. And she careered it, I think. I'll go on record and just say that. She's an LSU girl, so that probably ain't going to go good at an LSU Tiger reunion. But she's from Sweden. We won't let it go.
Here's another one. I'm going to bring up this gentleman. I actually just met him yesterday out at the Live Stuff out at RTJ. He's doing stuff. But I know he does a ton of stuff at Full Cry. Is Fat Perez.
Yeah, he was there yesterday. He played golf yesterday afternoon.
So
he's
a member there, right?
Well, you can say that, but I can't.
Okay.
I
just did.
Yeah. He's a great guy. And he was a junior golfer his parents were members at Farmington when I was there. And I gave him lessons when he was 6-7 years old. Wow. This guy's got a great golf swing. People just think that he's just, you know,
college golf at Hampton Sydney.
Yeah. And, you know, he's part of his shtick is that he's, you know, I hope at some point he's
not small.
There you go. The name says it all. But one day I'm watching my son, Sam, goes, Dad, I want you to watch this. He didn't know anything about me knowing. He goes, this is hilarious. I said, what is it? He shows me this video of this guy that he says is Fat Perez. And he's in Los Angeles, California, and he's being filmed wearing a GoPro, and he has to eat 4 Taco Bell tacos and play this par 4 in some public golf course, running down the fairway in 5 shots or less on some bet with all these guys that are watching him do it. And he's chugging these tacos, trying to whoop those down while he's playing golf. And I said, wait a minute. I know that guy. I said, that's Nick.
That's hilarious. I don't think I've seen that one, but that's sad.
It's hilarious.
I've seen some of the stuff they did.
It's club pro guy funny.
Yeah, I chose the wrong route doing traditional, you know, podcast stuff.
Well, we'll get you. We'll sneak you into a little bit of the genre. I'm not going to, we won't go too deep in the funny stories.
But I mean, those two kind of people that, I don't know if he's an official spokesperson, but he seemed, a lot of the stuff he posts are at Keswick Hall. And just the amount of people following both Lauren and Fat Perez, that must.
Well, Fat Perez all in has about 2.5 million followers,
yeah,
distinct viewers.
Have you been able to quantify that as far as like when he posts something that helps the.
This whole advertising world, my daughter is in this line of work where she's on the other side of it, managing people like Fat Perez.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
For her company, sniff.com. Now she used to work for lovewellness.com, but she's like in advertising and social media. I don't even have these accounts, so I don't know anything about it, but I get them through emails. I'll watch them. I'm so antique, but it's, who knows? You know, one of the things that my daughter Madeline says you can quantify it, that they can do these things where you get these click counts. I don't know. Maybe no one's listening to this today. Maybe there is no record of this, but I think if people get their hands on it, they're not going to be able to put it down. That's what we're, if they just stay tuned, it's going to get better, folks. Don't click you off yet.
We'll wrap it up on the actual, on the course itself before we get into your history and some other stuff. It's right outside of Charlottesville. I mean, it's probably two hours from here. How long did it take you to drive up here today?
2 hours and 11 minutes. I stopped. I made a couple of pit stops.
We're at Laurel Hill right now, right at Lorton, right on the patio. It's about 2 hours and 11 minutes.
Nice public golf course here. Yeah. It's nice that we have this here in Virginia. These people have a nice place to play. Alex for letting us come do this.
Absolutely. I need to play some more Charlottesville golf. Because Spring Creek, I've played a bunch, as I said, but that's now fully private.
Spring Creek is fully private.
But I played right when, speaking of Scott Sherman, because he's on Davis Love's team, so he's a big part of that, right?
Correct. He was the architect for that.
Okay. So I played that, like, it hadn't even really fully grown in yet. It had just done it.
And, you know, we're very lucky in our community. We have, first of all, Keswick's awesome, and we have memberships, and you can play. You can stay at the hotel for someone that lives up here that wants to give it a go. You can join at a very reasonable rate for someone that lives up here. We have Commonwealth memberships, Mid-Atlantic memberships, and national memberships. It's like a bullseye. And then inside of the 50-mile circle is a Keswick membership. So it's like a bullseye. The further away you get from the center, the less expensive it becomes. So it works out really nicely. So if someone wants to try a golf trip, it's a great place for that. If someone wants to go for the romance trip, do the whole spa thing. We have a world-class spa, do the good food, you know, stay in your room and have fun. You know, that's
so let's get into your history a little bit. Here at Keswick, you mentioned briefly you were at Farmington Country Club
for 27 years,
which is an insane run. But let's go all the way back to the beginning. One of the big reasons we're having you on this podcast, and we'll go all the way to the beginning, but is because we're recording this on a Friday. I'm going to publish this next week, which will be U.S. Open week at Oakmont.
Beautiful.
And there's a specific reason that maybe you're relevant on U.S. Open week at Oakmont specifically.
And it became a little bit more interesting because of this kid that just qualified.
Yes.
On Monday. I mean, so here's the story for me and why you bring that up. Thank you. It's hard to believe that if somebody told me when I was making a pair of triple bogeys on a one on each day that I qualified for the U.S. Open in 1983. I was 17 years old. I was a senior in high school. And at the time, they said I was the second youngest person next to Jack Nicklaus that ever played in the U.S. Open. And I was on ESPN, had just kind of gotten off the ground, and they had a partnership with the tournament. And they did three different interviews with me that were fun to do. And Jim McKay, the old Wild World of Sports, had me on a deal, like a 15-minute interview with Jim McKay as a 17-year-old. And it was just a great experience in my life. It really was. And now you had this kid that just did it the other day.
Right, junior in high school, going 63-63
in the sectional. I wasn't that good. I can't imagine shooting 63-63. I beat Bob Lohr, who was a tour player, in a playoff. I made it through the first stage in Louisville. You had to play two rounds back in the old days on the local qualifying. Right. I got it through. I carried my own clubs. I go to Cincinnati, and we had 43 guys for three spots. And I tied with three other people for the third place, and I got through in a playoff, and I'd gotten a lesson from Doug Sanders.
Okay.
The week before, I'd played in the Doug Sanders International Junior, and we went to his home, and I started schmoozing with him, and he says, come on back here, kid. He takes me back into his bedroom and just showing me around. And he's got this bedroom in it, in a closet the size of most people's bedrooms, full of nothing but shoes. He had about 300 pair of patent, every color you could come up with, patent leather shoes, and had carpet that was about 4 inches thick, white sheep wool carpet. And then I look up, he shows me, he goes, what about that bed, kid? I'm 17 years old. And he's got his wife there with him. It wasn't anything weird like that. It was just, he goes, what about that bed, kid? I look up and he's got mirrors on the ceiling. I was like, oh my God, this is like, anyway, he gives me a lesson the next day and shows me how to hit it low. He goes, I want to show you how to hit a low bullet, kid.
Right.
And, he called me Mac. He goes, Mac, I want to show you how to hit this low bullet. And sure enough, in the playoff with Bob Lohr, I hit some off the first playoff. Oh, I'm so nervous. I could barely breathe. I hit some foul ball over in the middle of absolute nowhere. And the only play I had was to take a one iron and hit it as about 175 yards in the air, about 3 feet off the ground. And I hit this shot that Doug Sanders had taught me how to
just
hit.
Just taught you.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That is cool. So were you, I mean, so that's insane. 17 years old, senior in high school, you qualify for the U.S. Open. I mean, you're saying it's not as much of a big deal than it is now. But were you, I mean, obviously, you must have been an incredible high school golfer. You grew up in Kentucky, right? Were you known outside of Kentucky at that point as a golfer?
No, I'm not sure I was known inside Kentucky. I mean, you give me more credit than I probably deserve. But I, things were just different then. You know, the AJGA had just kind of gotten off the ground. Golf, I mean, the head count will tell you. They had, I think, 5,500 people try to qualify for the U.S. Open then. I think close to 10,000 try now. It's just a bigger, harder deal. Yeah. Everything is bigger, better, faster, stronger than it used to be. But, but I was playing with a wood, a Bellotta ball, a steel shaft. I mean, things are just very different. And I know that players of my era and older, people that didn't really develop their strengths with the modern golf equipment. They, I know I do. We all think back, how far would I have hit it if I was playing with this stuff today? I'll tell you what's different about golf today is the spin rate of the golf ball is the fundamental driving difference for people to understand. I'm going to give your viewers, and this is really valuable, the difference with golf today with yesterday is the golf ball, if you looked at the best players, would have hit a golf ball that would have spun with a driver about 4,000 RPMs.
Okay.
Today, the best drivers in the world, the ball spins about 1,800 RPMs. And the launch angle back in the old days was very low, and then all that spin would kick in, and the ball would start low and then rise.
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to show my hand for the somebody listening. It's, you might want to have to go on your YouTube channel to see this.
Yeah, that much spin and to keep it straight, not just this.
So you played more on top of the golf ball with your golf swing. Today, the golf ball spins less, so you have to launch it up early, so it gets it to be more like a rainbow. And so it goes further. Spin is control, but it's also breaks in the sky. So it's trying to get that balancing act. So if you hit a modern golf ball with an old wood, it hardly would fly at all. They just sort of fall out of the sky because they don't spin enough. So the golf swing had to evolve, right? I mean, there's the real golf aficionados. Tell them to go try to find Gary McCord's talk from 1995 at the PGA Coaching and Teaching Summit, when he talked about the three things that parallel each other in the history of golf. The equipment, the model player of the day, and what is being taught. The best players figured out how to use whatever equipment was available, and then the teachers reverse engineer it, trying to copy what the best player's doing. And that's sort of been something that's gone on from the beginning of golf.
Right.
And so now the best players, because the ball doesn't flight, you have to launch that thing up in the air so much differently. Today, you have to swing differently. It's more back behind it, driving, catching everything on the upswing. Well, if you'd caught a wood, the head's that big, you'd have been like a Fred Astaire movie. It'd have been a topper. I mean, you know, you couldn't swing that way. You had to trap everything.
What about your game itself? Were you a bomber based on what you're saying? Were there bombers back then?
Oh, sure. I mean, what's shocking is you think about some of the people, how far they hit it. Nicklaus was the longest driver in golf. He was on television the other day. He showed his money clip from the 1963 PGA, which is amazing. He said it was 341 yards. 341 yards. I watched Davis Love when Davis Love was 15 years old at Harbortown. We were there playing in the Heritage Junior Tournament, and he's bombing these balls with the clubs of the day. This would have been in 1981, flipping drivers into the back of that range, these tall pine trees. He could hit it 300 yards. I mean, there were still guys that could hit it that far, but they were so few and far between. The average drive for a really good professional was about 265. I mean, Jim Dent just passed away. I played four of my first rounds, professional rounds of golf in the United States with Jim Dent, playing mini tour golf. He just died about a couple months ago or something, right? I mean, Jim Dent led the tour, I think, with like 291, 288 driving distance. Yeah. So just think about where we are today.
It's totally horrible.
It's crazy.
So what, tell me a little bit about, so you qualify for the U.S. Open.
Well, we'll get back on the Open. Sure. Sorry about that. I digress.
You know, what do you remember from, you know, from the time you qualify? Are you, I mean, you're a 17 year old kid. Are you just kind of the cock of the walk, or it must have been a huge deal.
Listen,
were you intimidated at all?
I was pretty much afraid of nothing. I mean, I wish I could find that guy again in my life. Right. Where did he go? You know, then you start reading stuff about you that people say you're cocky and you feel socially bad about that. And then you try to be a false humility. Well, when you actually go play in a U.S. Open, you get real humility thrown right at you. You don't have to fake it, because the golf course, you wait and see and watch what these guys shoot this week. The rough up there is knee high to a giraffe. I mean, I'm telling you, you could lose a ball in front of a green. I mean, you hit a wedge into a green, come up short, you may not find it. It was unbelievable. And there were so many cool things about that from a story point of view for me personally. The practice rounds I played and who I got to play practice rounds. I went up there with my dad. My dad was a lawyer, but nobody had any money. It didn't matter what your dad did. Nobody had any money unless you stole. I mean, drug dealers. I mean, you know, rich from the King George money. I mean, you know, so we stayed at some little Holiday Inn and get up there on a Sunday and go out to the golf course. And the first person I meet on the putting green was Gary Player. So I go up to Gary Player and ask him, can I play a practice round with you tomorrow? This was, you know, 5 PM. We weren't going to play that day. He says, sure, Robert, love to have you join me. So we show up and we play with,
This is Gary still basically in his prime, right?
I don't know if he would have been in his prime. Yeah, I mean, he would have been, this was 83. He was probably born in about 38, probably 30.
Most of his majors came in
37. Yeah. So he's probably at the end of his running out of, you know, eighth inning material of his career at the regular tour, but he's still fit as a fiddle and he was a real showman. I mean, we had a lot of people out watching
and a legend even then.
Oh my God. So it was a full round of golf of entertaining. I mean, he showed me some shots and how to hit different things. It was just like, I'm really having fun with it and I'm enjoying it. And as we finished the round, he goes, Robert, would you care to have lunch with me and Commissioner Beaman? I said, sure, I'd love to. You know, the Dean Beaman was the commissioner of the tour. So we go upstairs. It was like maybe a floor above the regular part of
been on this podcast.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he'll verify this. You should bring him back for proof. And I said, we go upstairs and sit at a little table, much smaller than this table here. Three of us having lunch in the locker room, and I didn't say too much, which is rare for me to not talk, but it was a very interesting subject matter. He goes, what these young lads need is a place to mature on the vine and a developmental tour where they can grow their game. And what happened 6 years later was the Ben Hogan Tour, which became the Nike Tour and the Nationwide, and which is today the Korn Ferry Tour. That all started, I think,
at that lunch. Interesting.
And Gary Player.
Wait, did he stay involved, like kind of driving that with Commissioner?
Well, I mean, I played a practice round in the Nevada Open, ironically, in 1988 with Wayne Player. And I asked him about that with his dad. He says, yeah, my dad has been pushing for this and I think we're going to have something. And it wasn't shortly long after that they announced that and the Ben Hogan Tour was formed.
Interesting. So what about the, I feel like I've heard in some other conversations, you had some other interesting practice rounds at that same.
Yeah. So the next day, I ran my race before the tournament ever started. I played a morning practice round with Jody Mudd, who at that time was an up and coming star, and a couple of Kentucky guys. Ralph Landrum was another pro from Kentucky that had qualified, and we finished the round, have lunch, go out on the putting green, and the ninth green on the course is connected to this putting green that's massive. This thing is, honestly, it's almost 100 yards from tip to tail. And who's coming up but Johnny Miller, Peter Jacobson, and the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Well, like I told you, I wasn't afraid of too much. I walked down there after they putted out and I introduced myself to him on the green. I said, "Mr. Palmer, I'm Rob McNamara. Could I play the back nine with you?" He said, "Sure, come on." So what was he going to say? I mean, he had to say yes, right? I mean, I'm not that good a salesman. He was just in a half to buy situation. So all these people around, everybody watching. So sure enough, I literally had to crawl under the ropes to get to the 10th tee. I mean, it was packed with people. They were 10 deep.
Like when you got to the Oakmont, did you know anybody there? Like, did you have?
I didn't know a soul.
Did you? I mean, nowadays.
I'm a little redneck kid from Kentucky.
Nowadays, I mean, even this high school kid from Georgia is probably going to bring some people. Like, did you bring a team? I mean, I'm sure.
My entourage was my mom and dad. My mom got buttons, McNamara's band. That was it. We did our best. But I sneak on the tee, you know, crawl under, and you could hear people. Oh, that's that high school kid. That's that young kid, you know. And I mean, my heart is pounding. You can just feel everybody's eyes on you. I mean, wow, that might have been the most nervous I've ever been in my whole life. So I wind it up, rare back on the 10th hole, rip this thing. This ball hit it dead solid. This ball takes off. It's going dead straight, goes out about 100 yards, and that hook spin kicks in, makes a hard left-hand turn, and 10 deep, everybody in the crowd, you know, ducks, try not to kill anybody. I hit this worst drive I've ever hit in my whole life. It was so embarrassing. God almighty.
Nowadays, that would be on Twitter.
Yeah, it would have been. It was, thank God I didn't have to sign any gloves and didn't hit anybody, you know.
What about the actual tournament itself out of Pan Am?
I shot 84-77. Okay. I shot 44-40, 39-38. I just ran out of racetrack. I was getting better.
Have you been up to Oakmont much?
I've only been back twice. I went back for when I was, there was a brief period in my life. I was a sports agent for my great friend Donald Dell at ProServe. I was in charge of his golf division here. Oh, wow. And my ex-wife wouldn't move. So he's the best. Yeah. He's the king. He's been a great friend of mine for, we were figuring it out the other day, 27 or 8 years. Oh, wow. So just the best. Love that man. And, I was doing an event for him to go check on something there. So I had to go for that when it still had trees. And then I went back for the U.S. Amateur 3 years ago. Okay. And of course there were no trees. It's like, holy smokes, this is not the same place. We're not in Kansas anymore.
What's your take on the, on how different it is and the new look and what Gil Hanson's done?
Well, anytime you have those open vistas where you can just see so far, I think is great. Do I wish they had kept some of the trees? Maybe, but you know, what do I know? And maybe when you think about it, it looks better without any. Once you start chopping up, you may just chop them all, but, it's a hell of a golf course. It's so hard. People have no idea how hard this golf course is. And they keep the rough up all the time. And the greens are as fast as this tabletop. And And it's just, it all depends on the weather. So the year I played, so I make the cut. I mean, if I'd made the cut, I missed the cut by 10 shots shooting. I had two triples and five double bogeys in the 2 days. That's 16 over. And I shot 21 over. So it wasn't terrible everywhere else. It was just
a couple bad holes.
Very mediocre. Yeah. So after 27 holes, I walked right off the ninth hole and a storm came like you can't believe. We had a 2 hour rain delay. And this golf course, when I was walked off after 27 holes, one under was leading the tournament. One person was under par, Bob Murphy. There was a person at even par and everybody else was well over. I'm telling you, 5 or 6 over would have won the U.S. Open that year. Well, it rained so much, it softened everything up. The greens became like a dartboard. And Larry Nelson made the cut on the number.
That happened, what, Friday night or Saturday morning?
It happened Friday late afternoon. And so it changed the whole vibe of the tournament. Sure. So Larry Nelson had shot a buck 51, 76, 75 to make the cut on the number. And he literally came in during that break and he sits down. He just eases down into his chair. And I'm sitting there with Hal Sutton, who I'd gotten to know during the tournament. He was befriended me and was super nice.
Sure.
And Larry just kind of eases down. He goes, Hal goes, Larry, what's wrong? You look like you're hurt. He goes, oh, I got these hemorrhoids. He goes, they're killing me. And so, you know, life goes on. Now it's, I'm going to fast forward and tell you a story that connects to this. So I meet Larry Nelson in Perth, Australia in 1990 when I was caddying for a friend. I had not qualified for a tournament and a buddy of mine was in the tournament. I meet Larry Nelson in the practice round. Actually, it was a pro-am and he played from the back tee. His amateur way ahead. So I'm walked down the fairway with him when I'm out scouting the golf course. And I introduced myself. I said, I met you at the U.S. Open and you had those hemorrhoids and then you shot 67 on the weekend to win the U.S. Open. So he knew. How else could you know that story about something that if it wasn't for real?
Been intimate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he ends up shooting a buck 32 on the weekend, 67, after the greens softened up and changed the golf course. And he goes from making the cut on the number to, you know, winning the U.S. Open by a shot over Tom Watson.
There's a tip in there somewhere, you know, maybe play better when you're a little bit uncomfortable on the backside.
You know? Keep you smooth. I mean, or maybe you need it to get smooth.
Right, who knows?
Anyway.
After that, it sounds like you had just a ridiculous college career. Went to play at LSU, made all SEC every year, 3-time All-American.
Man, you've done your homework.
I mean, that's a pretty absurd resume.
Well, like I said, I peaked too soon. I'm like a lot of horses that I bet on. I started fast and faded.
But you just mentioned Australia. At some point you ended up playing on the Australian tour?
Yeah, I did. I went down there after college and played for 2 seasons there. And I mean, you talk about some guys that can golf their ball. Those Aussies can golf their ball. And I'll tell you why, because the greens are hard as a rock and the wind blows like crazy. And you learn to play in heat. I mean, it's hot.
Yeah.
It is so hot and it's so windy and the ground's tough. I mean, you have to know how to play golf. That's why there's so many good Aussies. Sure. You know, you got a country that has 25 million people and they've, you know, you look at the world rankings over the course of history and they'll have 20% of the players in the top 100 in the world are damn near always Australians. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. I have not been to Australia. I've only watched, YouTube videos and some tournament coverage down there, but the golf down there looks insane.
Great golf. Yeah. Great golf. I played there 88, 89. So in 90, going back to finish the season, you would do 88, 89, and then you do 89, 90. So kind of going to be 2 seasons, kind of give people a history lesson on economics here. The interest rates around the world were skyrocketing. I mean, the old joke used to be what's a turn on for a woman? And the punchline was a job. I mean, you things were tough. The interest rates were 19.5% down there and they closed the tour, shut the tour down.
And you were on it when they shut it down?
Yeah. Basically, there weren't going to be any more tournaments to play in after this tournament that I caddied for my buddy and I meet Larry Nelson. And by the time that I finished telling him that story, he had hired me to caddy for him. I caddied on tour for 6 months and Larry was one of the people that I worked for. Yeah, that was a cool chapter in my life.
Did you play in any other tour events that ever? Did you qualify? And after that U.S. Open at Oakmont, did you get any other tour experience?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I played. I never had my tour card. I was just sort of good enough to get your hopes up. I think I played in 12 PGA Tour events, and I played another U.S. Open as a professional. I qualified in 1990 when I was caddying.
Okay.
So yeah, I was going to quit golf. I had a job to
go. I don't remember.
It was in Medina that year.
Okay.
And so I meet Larry. This is an interesting story. So I'm now I mean, there's so many stories here. I don't know if we have enough time to tell them all. But so I meet Larry Nelson that day in that pro-am. By the time I introduced myself to him on the tee, by the time we got to his ball and it was his turn to play, he had hired me to caddy for him. Oh, wow. I can sell.
Sure. I love it.
Okay. So anyway, he says, I want you to loop for me. I said, great. Meet me at the LA Open. Okay, great. Well, it wasn't like you just had information at the tip of your tongue in 1990. I thought I knew what the schedule of everything was, and I was off by like a couple of weeks. So I ended up doing a vacation, which is another story, but I ended up going to a casino in Perth, Australia, and somehow had some theory on a roulette wheel that I'll just do this black and red and have some deal. Well, 13 spins later, literally 13, I'm not making that number up, of playing black for 13 straight spins. It hit red, 13 straight spins. And guess what? I went ROM, which is ran out of money.
Oh, man.
And I literally, this was a Sunday night. The tournament was over. I'm flying to Sydney, Australia, 7:30 in the next morning. I had to sell my golf clubs to Kel Devlin, Bruce Devlin's son.
Okay.
I said, I got no money. I didn't have enough money to mark a golf ball. I didn't have a quarter to my name. But I had my ping golf clubs that I sold to Kel Devlin. He goes, how much you want for them? And I go, 700. He goes, Australian or U.S.? Here I am. I'm completely broke. I don't have a penny to my name, and I'm 81 cents exchange rate. I'm still willing to gamble. I said, U.S. He goes, oh, what the hell? Why not? I said, he's getting ready to pay me in cash. I said, no. I said, I need stipulation. I said, I need you to buy me breakfast before we get on the airplane because we're going to be on the same flight.
Only chance to get out of this country.
Yeah, buy me breakfast and don't pay me till we get to the parking lot away from this casino. And so sure enough, that's what we did, and he took care of me. I end up, that was my life. So I started caddying, and well.
How old were you during this story?
I was 24 years old.
24 again. I mean, you must have been, I mean, just to be willing to do that. I mean, I'm a gambler, you know, and I've got some interesting stories from when I was 24, but man, you're halfway around the globe
with nothing. I'm playing a game. You talk about Lee Trevino, talk about some of his gambling. Yeah. But I'm lose everything. I got no way to get home, nothing. And I'm gambling. I mean, anyway, so I started caddying on tour and then I was going to, like I said, I was going to go work for Merrill Lynch in Lakeland, Florida. The guy told me, he goes, you can start whenever you want to get here. He kind of sensed that my golf career had started to nosedive. And, you know, pretty quickly, I felt like that I didn't do well on my own. That was not I need a team around me. I think I do better with a team, but, sure. And not necessarily a golf team, but just a support team.
Yeah.
It's hard to be by yourself for half around the planet. You can get a lot of trouble. I didn't do drugs or alcohol, but I might have fancied a few other.
Sure.
Females in my life, but anyway, long story short,
I think that's probably the case with a lot. I mean, a lot of people, whether they're on tour or not, but yeah, you know, that's it's one just, of the things you hear so much about.
You're so bored and lonely,
right?
By yourself,
yeah.
You know, and being in another country by yourself, nobody around, it's a tricky deal.
I struggle when my wife goes out of town, and all of a sudden I'm eating steak off a frying pan, and you know, just being an idiot and not knowing how to take care of myself. And that's out of my house, let alone being on the other side of the world.
I met a guy named Harry Caddell that was a caddy on tour. He used to say, on the tee with Harry C. He was about 63 years old. He was an old guy. And here I am. I'm 24. So he's 40 years older than me. And he befriended me. And I had resolved myself. Well, first of all, I didn't have any golf clubs. I'd sold everything. So I had no way to practice. Well, along that journey, I ended up getting a set of clubs from Gabe Brewer, a fellow Kentuckian. So he gave me his clubs. Now I got a set of clubs back. He was, I don't know, somehow he got his hands on a set of pings. He gave me his pings of all things, which were what I'd always used. And Larry Nelson actually used my clubs, which were really Gabe Brewer's clubs, in a pro tournament when I was caddying for him at Doral. Well, about that time, Harry Caddell and I, he said, let's go hit some balls. I'd gone a long time without even hitting a golf ball. And we started going to driving ranges at night. And this guy started telling me how good I was. And I started believing him. And all I would do is go practice at night after we'd caddy. We'd go eat dinner and we'd go practice. We'd find a driving range, Atlanta, you know, Florida. We were finding some place to go hit balls together. Well, then I started trying to money qualify. Well, I qualified for the New Orleans Open. I qualified for a Ben Hogan Tour event. Then I entered the U.S. Open qualifier and qualified for that. I think, you know what? I think I'm going to go. I was caddying for Ian Baker Finch at the time, and I said, I think I'm going to go back and start playing golf again. Okay. And that's when I turned, you know, went back and started trying to play full-time golf. And again, I just good enough to get your hopes up and fizzled out. But it was a great life lived. I can tell you that. It was a great life lived.
Sounds like it. I imagine you've got a lot more stories. You know, if you're willing to tell the story about the roulette table in Australia, I'm sure you've got a lot. You know, and we're limited time here, so I'm sure I'm only scratching the surface.
Oh my God! Well, that's one that you can tell. There's a lot of we can't tell. I don't know. We have a viewership control on this audience.
I heard one or two when we had dinner. How old are you when that kind of decision happened? Where you know, professional golf is.
Well, I finally mailed it in. I said, you know, I just. It became depressing. I think nobody wants to do anything that they're not successful in.
Sure.
You know, and the lesson you learn about a guy like Harry Caddell telling me how good I am is a lesson that's so valuable in coaching. You hear stories of how so many coaches are good because they encourage.
Yeah.
You encourage people, and it's underrated. Everybody wants, especially in today's golf world, wants to put everything on the X's and the O's. You know, they want to draw the perfect swing.
Yeah.
It's not about that. That's only part of being a good player. There's a lot of great players that have very funky looking golf swings. There are less of them today than ever before because there's more information about what a perfect golf swing is supposed to look like. But do not underestimate 1 second. I want to make sure anybody that's listened to this, if they've gotten this far in the video or the audio, do not underestimate the value of telling yourself how great you are. Your self-talk, being around people that have positive self-talk, because it's real. It works. And that's something that I would want anybody that's, if you come see me, I'm not going to tell you that you suck for very long. I might, you know, my staff yesterday, we had a tough staff meeting yesterday. They might not tell you that, but I'm still going to get back on them and tell them I love them. I mean,
yeah. But that's gotta be, I mean, that's one of the reasons, I mean, mental coaches are so huge on tour now. Everyone seems like everyone's got one and they're becoming, I mean, some of them, a few of the well-known ones are becoming household names the way, you know, a swing coach would be.
Well, Bob Rotella is a member at Keswick. He was a member at Farmington. Bob Rotella is from Charlottesville. He is sort of the godfather of mental golf for, he certainly gets all the credit for it, in the sport of golf because as the sports psychologist, and he started the sports psychology department at the University of Virginia.
Yeah.
That said, and I love Bob. He is a great friend of mine. He's been so nice to me and I have never actually paid him for, hey, will you help me necessarily? But he helps me. He helps me just being around him. I mean, he's so wise. This guy could, and he's not just an athletics coach. He's a coach for corporate America. He's an executive coach. He's a great friend.
I didn't even realize. I know the Bob, I've never met him, but I know the Bob Rotella name from the books that he's written. And I've read a couple. But I don't even know when they came out, but they seem like they came out ages ago.
Well,
I just heard about
30 years ago. Okay, is when they started.
Yeah, a long time ago.
They're great.
After maybe the Masters of PGA Championship, I'm forgetting it. I want to say Rory McIlroy, but maybe not. But it was one of the top players in the world.
Well, he's Rory's.
It was Rory. They were talking about Rory and they're saying how he's, you know, still working with Bob Rotella. And I had no idea that he was kind of still actively working with.
He doesn't go out on tour as much as he used to just from the travel. I mean, Bob has gotten a little older. Bob's got one daughter, Casey, beautiful gal that's got 10 kids. They have 10, Darlene and Bob have 10 grandchildren.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they've got one of those Sprinter vans. It's amazing. So maybe Bob's having to go help, you know, right. Keep everybody fed. I mean, how can you afford to have 10 kids? I mean, in today's world, I can't afford to pay attention, much less, you know what I'm saying?
I've got two and it's chaos. That's wild. So, not to break down your, let somebody break down your age, but so at what point did you mentioned you almost became a stockbroker. When did you settle into the, the golf pro life.
I made the
Farmington was your first job as a club pro?
No, I hung on to pro golf. The ups and downs of the depression and the frustration and the joys, the limited joys. I mean, you still have successes in there. There's still wins and still these moments. There's nothing better. There's not a better high in the world. That's why would you ever do drugs if you can go play a tournament round of golf and play really well and beat somebody?
Yeah.
It's about as fun a feeling as you can have. I mean, why would you ever, if cocaine's like that, you know why people get addicted, right? I mean, I finally surrendered on all of that frustration at age 26. I went to go work for Buddy Alexander at the University of Florida. He was my golf coach in college, and he was the coach at the University of Florida. And I did that for 2 years, and I basically didn't play a tournament round for 19 months. And in the summer of 93, I started playing again, and I won 8 club pro events I won 24 club pro events in a 3-year period. Club pro, mini tour, in a 3-year window after having coached for 19 months without competing. I think all because of just being around kids that you had to be positive with. Mm. And then I went from Florida, then went to Kapalua in Maui, worked a season there. And then I came to Farmington, Maui, and learned to play golf in that wind after working in an environment where your sole job is to be upbeat for 20-year-olds and tell them encouraging things. Eventually you learn to listen to your own encouragement.
Yeah.
I mean, the person in the mirror is the most important person in our lives. When you talk to yourself, that conversation that we all have self-talk every day.
Sure.
People think it's snake oil. Well, I promise you, you're saying something to yourself. Are you saying good stuff or bad stuff?
Yeah. Right. So what I'm saying to myself usually depends on how much caffeine I have.
but you get my point, right? Absolutely. I mean, and there's so much going on in our heads all at the same time. Well, you do that for a living. You started thinking good stuff and you hit balls in the wind in Hawaii for 6 months. You learned to either strike it or quit.
Yeah.
So it got me encouraged to play golf again. And I moved to Farmington. I got married. We had started having kids. Have a beautiful daughter and son. My wife and I, we got along great for many years. It just ran out of racetrack. She's still great. I have no hard feelings about that whatsoever. Needed to make some money, and I get the call from Bobby McKeever to come to this place called Farmington Country Club in Charlottesville, Virginia. I couldn't spell Charlottesville. I didn't know where it was. Anyway, long story how I ended up here, but I ended up in Charlottesville and just went to work, and I was a PhD. I was poor, hungry, and driven.
It's a great combo.
I was just poor, hungry, and driven, and just tried to figure out how to make it work, and 3 years later, I became the head pro. And I had that little stint of working for Donald Dell for a few months as the running the golf division at ProServe. So there was a part of me that wanted to be an executive, and it just, the timing wasn't right for our family. So I was fortunate enough that Farmington, Bobby McKeever had taken a job at Greenville Country Club. That job then opened. I called Phil Keister, my former manager there. I said, is there any way I can get my old job back? He says, no, but you can come be the interim. I said, there's no way I can become the head pro. He goes, no, we'll let you be the interim, but you can't be the head pro. I said, why not? Summer of 97, I call him up and said, can I get my old job? He says, no. He goes, to call you a dark horse would be a long shot. Well, 3 months later, I went through all the interview process. I became the head pro, and I was the head pro there for a little over 24 years.
Mm, that's remarkable.
So
that's pretty rare. I mean, to be that long.
It was a long time. Probably it won't happen that often for that many people. Farmington's a special club and a really great place. Jeff Montrose, he's the pro there now. They did a great job when I left.
Came down from up here.
He's a great pro, great guy, doing a really good job. They're putting a ton of money into golf there. It's a nice place. I think where I am now, I don't want to compare one better than the other. Where I am now is where I want to be.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Yeah, I'm happy with where I am by big factor.
Excellent. Well, I want to be cognizant of, I've got too many devices here. I've kind of lost track of time, and I know you've got places to be. Wrap it up with, again, U.S. Open at Oakmont. You know, having played it 42 years ago?
42 years ago.
42 years ago, you know, what kind of feelings go through your head when you're watching it, or what do you expect?
Well, you cannot underestimate the value of driving it straight. Now, today's player seems to, you know, you look at the two people that have won there. Well, let's think about this. You had Larry Nelson win when it was a quagmire for 36 of the 72 holes. Johnny Miller famously shot 63 on the final round after a huge weather event on Saturday. It rained like crazy on Saturday, became like a dartboard. Johnny Miller shot 63 last day to shoot 5 under to win. Larry Nelson shoots 1 under to win. Then Ernie Els wins in a playoff there.
Right.
And I think he shot 1 under to win. Cabrera wins.
Yep.
I think he was over par by what, 4 over?
I don't remember, but.
And then I think Dustin Johnson was, you know, that's the round where the ball moved and all that business was kind of weird. And,
and
he was, I think, was over par.
Yeah.
If it doesn't rain, if it rains and starts softening it up that way, cause, you know, Dustin Johnson drove it a mile, but he ball was slowing down. It wasn't running into the rough. Cabrera wins there. Wasn't running into the rough. But if that ball starts running into the rough, it's tough. You got to be a man to get it out of there. You got to be so strong to get it out of that rough. Well, I'm going to go on the record. I'm going to say if it doesn't rain, I'll say 2 over wins. And I want Justin Thomas to win.
That'd be fun.
I want a fellow Kentuckian.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's been playing good golf. I mean, he kind of had a dip there for a year or two, and he's playing real good golf now.
I think we're seeing an evolution in the golf swing. Players that play great now have high hands. So if you want to have your listeners, if they want to do an interesting study, go look at the position of the hands in the backswing and the migration of that in the history of golf. It went from high to around to high to around back to high again. The best players. And again, it's that whole deal. People start modeling what the best players are doing in today's equipment with today's golf ball. Scottie Scheffler, high hands. Justin Thomas, high hands.
Early Tiger, high hands.
Yeah. And look when he got screwed up. When his hands are high, he played good. When he got the chip yips and that deal with when everybody watched him like duff it on the, in 2013, his hands were way back around behind him, and somebody started smelling snake oil to get people to start getting their hands back around. Just because Hogan's hands looked like they were flat, go look at where Hogan's follow-through was. Way the hell up. Get those hands up in the air on the backswing, folks, and you'll hit it a lot better.
There you go.
That's your tip of the day.
Love it. We'll end it there. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much. You're a good man.